July 5th, 2011, it's the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you. that.
Yeah, it's cool. Watt from Pedro show, except not in Pedro, here in Lisbon, Portugal. And on a Tuesday, day of the 4th, after the 4th, I got a guest here. I should introduce you people. How do you like being told you are?
You can, whatever you want to call it.
It's Larry. And he's on the drums. Some people call him Toby Dammit. He had to come to the rescue and help out Stooges with these gigs, and he did. And he's doing a great job. I should tell you, we start off the show with John Coltrane doing two bass hit, an alternate take. And then we heard This Ain't the Fucking 1980s by the Super Fast Girly Show. Those cats were at the gig in Chester.
Oh, yeah, they were there.
Okay. He gave me his thing there. His name was Phil. Nice. Good people. And that was your second time.
Yeah, that was the second show.
Yeah, first one was the day before in Tunbridge.
Yeah, that was the frying pan.
Frying pan. I want to start off with how you started off. How did you get into music? What's your earliest music memories?
Well,
like listening?
I mean, you
or
know.
Did
I,
you start playing before you ever heard anything?
No. I was listening to rock and roll and country music and everything way before I ever tried playing an instrument. You know, like I liked a lot of. And I discovered punk rock and stuff when I was pretty young. I grew up in East Tennessee where you couldn't really get access to music outside of that area so easily. You know, and not like today where you can just, you know, access anything. Back in those days, I mean, I knew about, you know, bluegrass music and country music that my parents were listening to there in East Tennessee. And then I got curious, you know, going to the record stores and stuff like that around outside of Knoxville, you know, and I found like weird stuff, you know, like I found like Parliament Records really when I was really young and started listening to George Clinton. And I got really into that. And then one day I found like a Sex Pistols record, you know, which I just thought, wow, it looks so crazy, you know, and I checked that out and I discovered Sex Pistols and Stooges, you know, that Raw Power record, you know, that cover. It's just the covers, you know. I just thought, wow, you know, what looks so crazy, you know, what is that, you know. So I found that stuff, and I got a hold of that stuff pretty quick, and so I knew about that, and of course a lot of the popular heavy rock and roll that was around there.
You play in school? Like have a music class?
I did. I got into that in seventh grade. I got into that because my best friend basically... my best buddy there was a drummer, and he had an invitation to go to like summer camp, you know, because he was about to get old enough to go into the marching band, and so they had summer camp. So the idea was like he was like, look, you got to get into this thing so we can go hang out together at summer camp. So I thought, well, I don't know what it is, or I don't even know anything about that stuff, but yeah, I mean, why not? We can hang out. So I joined the band. Which in seventh grade was more or less like a classical music operation.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about anything. And I got in there, and the teacher was a really, really cool guy. His name was Ken Jarnigan. And he, you know, he sort of like made me do like a little audition kind of thing, and then sort of like start teaching.
Audition, but you didn't ever play.
I didn't know anything, but just like, you know, show me how to like, you know, hold sticks.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, anyway, for some reason, I don't know why, but for some reason I just kind of latched on to this whole scene and just kind of ate it alive. You
it
know,
was like, classical. I remember school band too.
Yeah.
Did you relate it with the records you were listening to?
Not at all. I was really intimidated, but somehow I understood it all really fast, and I really took to it and started studying Bach, and before long I was studying Bartok and Berlioz and all kinds of other stuff, and all of a sudden I turned into this sight reading, you know, nightmare from hell. I could play anything, and I became like this guy's sort of prize prize student, and he really kind of took me under his wing.
This is like junior high, huh?
Yeah, yeah, and he was like, he realized that I kind of had something for this, and I couldn't explain it, but I could really do it, and so he started entering me into all these competitions and stuff statewide, and I would win everything. You know, I started studying timpani, and I could play all Bartok, and you know, when I was 12, you know, I was playing Bartok. And Bach, and just studying all this stuff. Same time when I go home, I'm listening to the Sex Pistols and the Stooges.
There's no real gigs, right?
Well, there are classical performances. I would get into these.
No, I mean of the rock gigs. You're not really going.
No, not until I was 14. And but when
so
I was
the music you're seeing live is these symphonies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was really into it, and yeah. I even studied. You know, I studied Berlioz and their lives and everything. You know, I really got into it, and I kind of had a career building in a way, and I wound up getting a full scholarship. You know, when I got out of school, you know, to go and study classical music and teach and all this kind of stuff, but. When I was 14, and I had a private instructor who had been teaching me just snare drum, classical snare drum and all this stuff, and then at a certain point, he was like, have you ever played a drum set? And I said...
Oh, because in the band...
No, it was...
Standing
just,
up with a snare
I'm studying Bach, you know, and he knew I could do all this stuff, but he was like, have you ever played a drum set?
Like no trap.
Yeah, never. I had no interest.
I've seen classical guys, they have like... these things set up.
Yeah, I had no interest in that. Okay. You know, I never bothered. I mean, I couldn't afford to buy a drum set.
You must have saw on the album covers that some dudes were playing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I loved listening to it, but I mean, I grew up really poor. I couldn't afford to buy.
Sure.
Buying a drum set was like something, you know, like it's buying instruments is like...
I know. D. Boone's brother played it. When he played in the bedroom, his little brother played. And he just had a snare drum.
Yeah.
And he put a book on it.
Yeah.
And that would be the kick drum.
Yeah, you know,
a little metal TV stand. That would be the cymbals.
I probably had like a lone snare drum from the school, but that was it.
Yeah.
And then I had this private teacher that I'd been working with, and then a certain, you know, and he had a drum set there in his place, and he's like, "Have you ever played drum set?" I said, "No." He's like, "Well, let's like fool around with that." So he sat me down and kind of like started, you know, teaching me how to like, you know, expand all the things I had been studying, but to do it on you know, across all these other things and using my legs and all that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
And
because you're standing up, right?
Yeah.
You weren't using legs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, I did that and you know, quickly got into it. And he, you know, he was teaching upstairs in a music store, and he was like, "Look, you know, we got to work something out with your parents." So he had a meeting with my parents and
get you trapped.
Yeah, he had a meeting with my parents and the owner of the music store, and he was like, "Look," he kind of served as a conduit to like negotiate like a
kind of payment trip,
a payment, you know, like a low payment thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, "We got to get this guy like a little drum set, something decent, and they don't have any money, and let's like work it out."
Yeah,
and
yeah. And that's very cool. What's this cat's name?
What was his name?
No, because not just conduit between the store and your parents, actually with you and your future as music.
Yeah, you know, I'll have to think about
that. Remember the teacher, though.
I'll have to remember his name, but he actually got this worked out, and I got the kit and continued like taking lessons with him, and you know, of course that accelerated at a rapid pace, and before long, once I had this kit, of course, it combined with my knowledge of punk bands and all this kind of stuff and all these other, and my buddies in school, when they found out that I had a drum set, then I wound up
I'll
like
play with you.
Yeah, I wound up getting, you know, that was the magic thing, you know, like then we wound up putting a band together. And
when you started on the trap, did you have some kind of drummers you kind of like, maybe I try something that he's doing, like a role model or a little bit?
Well, I don't know. I mean, at that point,
I like
point,
Mitch Mitchell, or I like. You didn't know, really, as persons.
I didn't really...
I didn't know much.
I didn't really know. I can't say that I want to be like that guy or that guy or that guy. I mean, I know what I was listening to, but I don't think I knew enough about any of those people
to
say, like, you know, I mean, I can't be a John Bonham or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, I knew about all this kind of stuff and Peter Criss and all this kind of shit. You know, but I just thought, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, but I knew, I could play that drum kit, so... I got in a band when I was 14.
Influence, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, I don't know. I was just listening to, like, degenerate culture in general.
Yeah, right, right. You didn't realize, hadn't gotten to personalizing, like, the instrument of the guys working the machines.
Yeah.
It was all sounds.
Yeah.
That's how it was for me for a while, too.
Yeah.
It was all sounds. I couldn't really separate.
Yeah.
I couldn't hear bass on a lot of records.
Mm, yeah, that's true. Well, it wasn't meant to. Until, like, those
Creedence records,
yeah.
I couldn't hear the bass parts for anything. I could hear Entwistle. I could hear Jamerson on the Motowns. Larry Graham on the slide.
Yeah.
Bruce and the Cream.
Right.
A lot of the England guys, I could hear the bass. But, man, it was mysterious.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It was.
Yeah. You know, I was lucky enough, though, this band that I got into, they got a gig in a punk club in Knoxville, opening up for a popular local band. And so they snuck, you know, we took the gig, and I was so young, you know, I was too young to be legally allowed in that place. So they had to sneak me in the back door for the sound check, and then I had to go back out the back door right after, and then... And then I could come in for the gig, like, right before we went on. They snuck me in the door. And then right after the last song, I had to get out of the back door.
Wow.
And so, I mean, but I did it, you know.
I
was 14. But I got that taste, you know. I got that taste for, like, that excitement of being in those punk clubs and just the lights and the smell of beer and all that kind of stuff, you know. Dirty carpet and nasty stages and all that. It's like, you know, that was my first... Kind of.
And what kind of songs were they playing? Did they write them or were they covers?
I think that first band we were doing covers and then we wrote some. We had some and it was a punk band.
Because our whole thing was about copying records. We didn't know anybody in our town.
Yeah.
Until punk was when we met people who wrote their own songs.
We were doing like more like punk rock cover versions of like early rock and roll stuff, you know.
We were trying to copy the records best we could.
Yeah.
We really had a tragic experience of people booing us and throwing us off stage and throwing shit at us.
Yeah.
This before punk came.
Punk
came, that happened too.
Yeah, in a way.
Sometimes the booms, we played a high school thing with after the football game and Carson beat us bad. Everybody's in a bad mood already. And it's one of these portable trailer things at the jetty.
Yeah.
And maybe 3-4 songs into it, man, they're just throwing everything they could, and the singer man, God, he ended up hanging himself. But he did. He was in Alice Cooper and stuff, and did this fake blood thing. And the boss running the thing thought, "Whoa, he got hit in the mouth with the rocks and shut the power off."
Oh,
I was barefoot, and he just swung it the other way, the ground. And I got all shocked. Through the crowd in the pickup truck, comes up to the brother's day, and we get in there and got us out before they killed. It was just six. We were 16. It was terrible.
Man, that's a disaster.
Yeah, there was a lot of those. We didn't know enough to call them character builders, but that's great that you had your first one was affirmation.
Yeah, I mean, well, that was my first, you know, first bite of the tablet, really, you know, because, I mean, once I got the taste of that, that was sort of like, that just turned my life, you know. I mean, I continued this whole, like, classical thing, like, all through, until I got out of high school, you know, I kind of saw it through all the way to there, and then, but I, at that point, I was playing in all these bands and stuff, and then I went into college for one semester on this big classical scholarship, and everyone was really excited and supporting me, and it was going to be all this big career and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I just threw it all away.
Fuck this.
Yeah. And I was
what happened
like,
to that band? Did you continue with them?
No, I didn't. I mean, that lasted a year or something. And then, I got tossed around in a few local bands here and there. I kept trying to get something going, but... Finally, I had one that was going really good, and we all moved in together. We were living together.
Totally
inspired by the Stooges, you know, because, you know, I'd read that I Need More book from Iggy. So, and I always thought, you know, a band should all live together. You know, they should all live together, and everybody's got their own bedroom, you know, and they come down and, you know, have breakfast together and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's like a family. And, you know, so we kind of had that kind of thing going. And, you know, and I thought,
You were telling me about Buddy Rich. Was this around 14?
Yeah, it would have been around that. Well, maybe 16 or so, 15 or 16.
And you go see him play.
Yeah. He played. He was playing in the Knoxville area there, and my new classical teacher at that time had been friends with him or was an acquaintance with him and was close enough to get me passes, you know, into the show and a backstage pass to meet him after the show. So I got to sit there and watch him in person, which was something I'll never forget. And
The blur.
The only human blur I've ever seen in my life. The hummingbird. He turned into a hummingbird. The only person I've ever seen who could move their physical form so fast, their limbs so fast, that they actually disappeared. You know, you could only see his abdomen. It's just standing stationary, just sitting stationary on his behind his drums, but you could not see his arms anymore. Because he would be moving so fast, but he wasn't moving his central, you know. Yeah, it was just his arms, and it was like
a pillar.
Yeah, it was like a magical. I mean, it was like karate. I don't know. It's like some sort of like incredible physical feat. What he could do, and I'd never seen that before, or never since either.
And so you wanted to see him after the game.
I got to meet him, you know, after the show. I thought, okay, I've got my piece of paper. I'm going to go, like, get his autograph. And I think, oh, this is it. This is my big chance to meet Buddy Rich. And I go back. And at that point, I had not been warned of the character that I was about to encounter. But, you know, I went back, and he was already on his old, like, tour bus, you know, it was parked back there. And there was a line of kids already at the door, and I could see, like, the old bus doors would open, and one person would come on, and then another person would come off, and it was one at a time kind of thing. And
like the Pope.
Yeah, like the Pope. And so, you know, my turn was coming up, and I was really anxious. I don't know, I must have been 15 or 16. And so my turn, the guy comes off the bus door is open, and it's my turn. And I hear this voice yelling, going, "Next!" And I think, oh, well, like, who's that? You know, like, and I go up on the bus, and there he is. He's already in his nice, like, fluffy bathrobe, like, beautiful, sitting at his little picnic table in the bus, you know. And I give him my paper, and I'm like, oh, Mr. Rich, you know, that was one of the most awesome things I've ever seen in my life. You know, I play drums, and what an inspiration to me. You know, I've never seen anyone in my life do things like that. You know, I'm never going to forget it. You're my hero. Thank you so much. And all this, you know, I'm just, you know, pleading, you know, just a teenager, you know. And he signs my paper, Buddy Rich. And he hands it to me, he looks at me in the face, and he goes, "Next!" and I was looking at him, like, in trauma, like, I just turned around, you know, and like...
Here, let's listen to some Buddy on the tour bus.
If we come down there, it's going to work out that way. You motherfuckers sit out there and crap all over this fucking joint. What do you think this is, anyhow? What kind of plane do you think this is? What kind of Miss Cutie do you call this? What fucking band do you think you're playing on, motherfuckers? You wanna fuck with me on a bandstand? Shut that fucking door. I'm up there working my balls off, trying to do somebody a favor, and you motherfuckers are sucking all over this joint. What kind of trumpet section do you call tonight? And saxophones? You gotta fucking be kidding me! How dare you call yourselves professional? Assholes are playing like fucking children up there. You got your fuck, where the fuck are you? This boss. You got your fucking heart so far deep in the fucking bell, we don't need to have a band here tonight. Your phrase won't be heard. Everybody can hear your fucking clams out there. You don't need a mic for that. You got too much fucking time? Blow on what? Shit! You stand out here all fucking night trying to blow your fucking brains out when it comes time to play. What are you playing? Clams? You got nowhere to fucking go to next day, because if I hear one fucking clap from anybody, you ban it. One clap, and this whole fucking band is through tonight. Try me. You got fucking nerve. Lights off, nothing to do, and you're going to play this kind of shit for me? fuck all of you. You're not doing me any fucking favors. You're breaking my heart up there. I gotta go up there and be embarrassed by you motherfuckers. I play with the greatest fucking musicians in the world. How dare you play like that for me? How dare you try to play like that for me? Assholes. I get 15 fucking kids in rehearsal for fucking time, and this band is incredible. We don't play two fucking bars in one fucking tempo. Not one. You can't keep fucking time to play. There's too many things to do, isn't there? You can't fight your fucking foot and play. You're all over the fucking place. Missed you after missed you. You try one fuck up the next day, and when you get back to the office, you'll be in another fucking job. Count on it. Get out of my fucking bus! Right now!
If you can't do it, get off my fucking band tonight! You had a day off yesterday and you come back like this and you suck! What the fuck kind of music do you think you're playing here anyhow? And who do you think you're playing for? You think I tolerate that shit? You're worse than any fucking high school band I ever heard! Come in wrong because you leave one fucking beat out, you can't find one? I don't know what kind of drummers you think you're playing with. But you play with me or you get out. And I mean now. I don't need this shit. I have a home in Palm Springs that I can go and sit on my ass the rest of my life and not worry about a fucking thing. I don't have to meet your fucking payroll and play you for playing like a fucking high school dropout. How dare you do that? Assholes. You can't play a simple fucking tune. You can't hold a chord. You can't play time when you play solos. What kind of solos am I hearing tonight? If you want to rehearse and practice, get a fucking band in Sydney and play the kind of shit you want. Over here, you play time. You don't like what I play, get the fuck out. I'm tired of putting up with you. I'm tired of signing for you. I'm tired of you, period. And I'm tired of all of you guys that can't go up and play a fucking job for 45 fucking minutes. You got it too fucking easy, goddammit. I'll make it so fucking tough you won't be able to breathe around here. How many fucking bands do you think you've got to go to work in? If I decide to quit, you are sucked. You got nothing. Try it. You think I'm fooling? You can quit tonight. I'm gonna knock my fucking band out, and I gotta carry you and pay you at the same time. Fuck you! When I go back inside, I've gotta hear 110% perfection, or I'll leave you here. I'll take you as far as he's right, and you got it. Try me, fucker. Try me the next day and see if you get away with one thing of shit. You try it. I'll fire you on a fucking bastard. You not only insult me, but you insult yourself. Do you have any more pride? Raise your fucking pride. Raise your professionalism. Asshole. That's what play like. Raise your own fucking pride in yourself. Why don't you have it here? You're so fucking dumb that you don't have any pride. Get out of here! Right now! I'm still gonna do it! You get up in this fucking bastard and you play your ass off!
Two fucking weeks to make up your mind that you want to clear and you want a job. Not have this shit. This man, not the goddamn House of David, fucking baseball team, the Woody Rich Band, young people, good faces, no more fucking beer. Now! If you decide to do it, you're through. Right now! This is the last time I make this announcement. No more fucking fans. I don't want to see it because you're going to shave it off. I'll treat you just like they treat you in the fucking arena. This is the way I want my band to look. If you don't like it, get out. You've got 2 weeks to make up your mind. No idle request. I'm telling you how my band is going to look. You're not telling me how you're going to look. I'm telling you. You've got 2 weeks to make up your fucking mind. You have it.
I'm not going to do what you want to do, but I want. I'm going to do what I want. I present myself, man. The image I present is what I want. Not what you want.
tell you one thing. You keep your fucking mouth shut, get the fucking thing off, or get off the band right now. Now, what do you think about that? Now, that's a definite suggestion. When you go to work tonight, if I catch the fucking bird on you, I'll throw you off the fucking band. Okay? You what? The truth. Right now. You don't tell me what to do. I tell you. You don't like it? Get off. Get off. Get your fucking clothes and get off. Right now. Pull the fucking bus over. Oh, I got what? I got nothing for you. I got a right hand of your fucking brain if you want it. I'll give you 2 weeks. 2 weeks for what? You run the rules of my band. You don't like it. That's it. You get off. And try to take me to the fucking union. I'd love it. I'd love it. You get no 2 weeks money. You get 2 weeks time. Get off. I was waiting for this for a long fucking time. Ever since you opened your fucking mouth, because I don't like the way you write. And I still play your fucking charts. For you. You understand that? Not for me.
I'll even play my charts.
Because what?
This particular Manhattan is the best chart in the book.
It is?
Yes.
Then take Manhattan and get off. I'm a success without you and without your writing. You understand that?
I know that.
All right, so don't tell me what the best chart in my book is.
Well, I certainly got there the best.
It goes over the best?
Listen,
go back to Sydney and whatever you do over there, good luck. Not over here. Just, I want to know what my book is. Right now.
Thank you.
From Pedro Show. That was Basho with Funky Monkey. And before that, we had Chloe Mons with 3 Days in Banjul. Before that, Lace by Mel. And start off with the Motivational Pep Talks live on the tour bus with Mr. Buddy Rich. Mr. Larry, little did you know that he was not really a one-word man. It wasn't just next. He had a bigger vocabulary. I think he said motherfucker 132 times. Some dude counted on that thing.
Well, I remember seeing him on stage, and he was living up to those tapes you had there. Because I saw him on stage before I ever heard those tapes. But I remember during the show, he was so cruel to his band. When, you know, of course, he was in the center of the whole thing. Center front was Buddy Rich, well lit and a big riser, and then the horns were off to the side, right? And you know, if one of those guys, like, you know, when one of them would take a solo, they, you know, when the solo would come up, they'd stand up, you know, out of their chair,
like old days.
Yeah, like the old days. And that guy's going to take a solo, and if it wasn't good enough for him, he would yell. Like he had a microphone, you know, they were going through a PA at that point, and he had a microphone. He'd be like, "Is that the best you can do? Let's check." You know, like, it totally humiliate.
During the tune.
Yeah, while the guy was soloing, like cut him off, you know.
You're done.
Like, literally, totally humiliate the guy, you know, like, and, you know, and then they go into the change, you know. I mean, he was controlling that band with a whip, you know, an iron whip.
Cruel. There's several approaches to music. Two of these things I played here, these ladies, you had something to do with.
Well, yeah, both these ladies. These are both Mel and Chloe Mons. They're both French women. These records, Mel's record came out in France in this past April, and Chloe's record just came out in May. And, Mel found me. She came to see a show that I did with Jesse Evans a couple of years ago in her hometown in Metz, and she contacted me, and she actually came to Berlin and kind of sought me out to help her make this record and produce this record. And she didn't have a band or anything like that, and so she really was kind of starting from scratch, but she had her songs. And the first stuff she played me was very, very much kind of gun club influenced stuff, and she was a big fan of Jeffrey, obviously, and I said, well, look, you know, one of my really good friends is Kid Congo Powers, and he's just living in Washington, D.C., and I mean, if you want, you know, I mean, I realized the stuff was good enough that he would take it seriously, and so I contacted him and asked him if he would be into doing it, and we decided to do it together. So I put this band together. It was me and Kid Congo Powers and Falker Snyder, the bass player from Calexico, because he just lived down in Munich, and he and I were in touch a lot. So we put this pretty interesting band together for her. And then she would come to Berlin from France and, like, stay off and on. I got her apartment in Berlin, and we just put this record together. And we put a lot of work into this thing. She's toured all over the United States as a solo artist. She'll go around with just a guitar, and she'll play all over the United States, anywhere. Yeah. And she's done it many times. She's played all down in the South and all in rural USA. And it's pretty rare for a French artist to have the guts to go do that by themselves. She'll travel alone.
Respect her.
Yeah, but from doing that, she has this incredible perception and understanding of American culture and history of American music, and she's really, really into it. She's a great musician. She's a really good banjo player and a really good guitarist, and she's really into, like, Harlem jazz and bluegrass and Southern California punk rock and old, like, Delta blues and all kinds of stuff, and she really knows what she's talking about. We could talk all night long about the history of where stuff comes from, and so I really kind of hit it off with her musically. You know, and I know a lot about all this stuff too, and so we were able to communicate really well musically. You know, about, like, every song she wanted to have every song different, and she wanted to basically take a stab at all these musical genres that she was talking about, and which is really brave for a European artist to even try that. So we did it. We tried Harlem jazz. We do some rockabilly. We do some country, like proper Nashville country. We do some punk rock. We're all over the place with this thing, and she did such a great job with it. And, you know, of course, Kid, who is a great guitarist, also knows a lot about all these different styles, and so does Falker, and we were able to make a really authentic take on all these songs. It's a great album, and it's not available in the United States. I really
it's
hope
called
that
Western Spaghetti.
Yeah, which I thought was the perfect name, because it's her take on Americana. It's her take on American culture, so it's like a Western Spaghetti. And I think it's a great album.
Well, maybe she's got a website or something that people can go.
Yeah, there's. I think she's got a MySpace page. And
well, maybe they can get the record, though. You know, people get them online now.
I know that. Yeah, it's only available in France for the moment, but I'm trying to help her find a way to get it over to the United States, because that's really where it should be. So.
We'll look for, and then here, Chloe.
Yeah. Well, the other woman, her name is Chloe Mons, and this is a completely different story. She's made a couple of records in France before, and she's a famous actress and model in France, and she was also married with a very famous French artist named Alain Bashung, and. Alain passed away a couple of years ago, and she basically was preparing to make a new record, and most of this album there are very personal songs about her relationship with him, and she contacted me and wanted to make the record together, but she wasn't quite sure where, and she wound up contacting Malcolm Byrne, who is an old friend of mine. I don't know if you know who Malcolm Byrne is, but he's produced a couple of Emmy Lou Harris records. He produced a record for Iggy. I got him to produce American Caesar, which was the first record that I made with Iggy. And so we've been pretty good friends I think I met Malcolm in around 87. And anyway, she contacted him And he invited us over to do it, and that was in upstate New York. So Chloe and myself and her guitarist, Jan Peschun, who was Alan Beschun's guitarist, the three of us all went over together and made this record in Malcolm's house. It's the same place where Emmylou Harris had made the two records with him. And it's just in his basement. And we went over there with no rehearsals or any preparation of any kind, actually. I didn't take any instruments or anything. I didn't know what I was going to do. And we went over there.
Got your drums.
Well, no. Not really. We talked about it. And she she sent me like a little demo of her songs alone. And we talked about the style, which was very much like in a sort of early John Lee Hooker kind of style of writing, which is more or less like prison blues. And I was like, well, for this kind of stuff, you know, you wouldn't really have drums in this thing. And if you really want to make it like that, you know, like I think we would go more with like, you know, big pieces of wood or like some big pieces.
Oh, still percussion.
Percussion, but not drums.
Yeah.
And so I said, I'm not going to take anything. As we get there, I said, I'll tell you what, when we get there, first day I get there, I'm going to find out where the local junkyard is. And I'm going to go out to the junkyard and I'm going to take apart a truck. And we're going to bring it in there, and I'm just going to beat the hell out of that. And that's what we're going to use. And she loved that idea. So I got there, and I didn't have to go to the junkyard because I talked to Malcolm about this real quickly. And I said, look, I think I basically need a big piece of wood and a big piece of metal. I need a high end and low end.
Yeah.
And you know, and of course he's got all these great microphones, all this incredible gear. And anyway, so he had a beautiful old filing cabinet from World War II out in his garage. And I said, is that thing not so precious to you? And he said, no, you can use it. I said, no, I took that as my high end, and that was my right fist. I beat the hell out of it with my right fist. And then the other thing he had, which was fantastic, he had a big old birdhouse hanging on a tree out in his backyard. I mean, really, really big. And I was like, can I take that down, you know? And it was made out of pretty thick plywood and probably about 20 years old or something, so it was aged. It was basically a really big wooden box. And it was perfect. It had a big hole in the bottom of it for the birds to come in and out of it, or the squirrels. And that was perfect. That was for the bass to get out. Yeah. And it was more or less like a big primitive hillbilly cajon, you know, or whatever. Yeah, you know, it was like a real hillbilly version of one of those things.
Yeah.
And I beat the hell out of that with my left hand. So that was my low end and my high end. And, you know, and I could beat them together, you know. So we did all this like prison blues stuff. And we literally spent about an hour and a half on each song. And we tracked three songs a day with all the overdubs and everything on there.
Yeah.
And the live vocals. And we recorded that record in 3 days. 12 songs in 3 days. And then we mixed it in 2 days, and then we mastered it at the end of the week. It was a 7-day production, start to finish.
Yeah, respect.
And it was a lot of fun. I think we actually had a fourth day planned, and we were already done, so we drove around in a car and listened to it. And we all decided, no, we don't need to do anything else. We're done. So it was a thrill to move quick.
Speaking of moving quick, we kind of confused everybody because we've jumped ahead to these days. But let's twist back now. You're in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And you're playing in bands.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I'd gotten into all this kind of thing. And I had a band going for a while that I believed in, this band we were all living together and stuff. And
right, Stooges style.
Yeah, and that kind of fell apart. And it fell apart and closed down. And I was trying to figure out what I should do. And the number one thing in my mind was, I got to get the hell out of here. I got to get out of
Knoxville.
I got to get out of Tennessee. I got to get out of the South. I got to get out of here completely. I'm not going to go anywhere here. There was a lot of police down there.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, and I just thought, at that time there was no support for local bands or musicians or anything. If you wanted to be a musician, the only thing that made sense was for you to become a high school music teacher or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, so I realized, like, I had to get out of this whole area. And I didn't know how, I didn't have any money. And anyway, right around that time, Iggy had actually kind of come back on the scene after being vacant for several years, and he had a new record out, and he was on tour.
Yeah.
And I'd seen him on television, and he had played a live show on MTV in New York with this new band doing this show. And he spent the whole show screaming at his drummer and throwing stuff at him and just wrecking the whole thing. And it looked like there were big problems. And anyway, I proceeded to check out his tour dates, and I noticed that he was playing some shows in Tennessee. He was playing in Memphis and in Nashville. So me and a friend drove to Memphis to see him play. And we got there, and he came on stage, and there was a new drummer. And it couldn't have been 2 weeks later. So I realized, oh, he's changed. He fired that guy.
Yeah.
And the new fellow that he had, guy was a good drummer, but it was kind of painfully obvious to me that he didn't really know the material that well. He didn't really understand like what that stuff was. You know, like what he didn't know these songs. And of course, I knew this stuff by this point, like, you know,
back of your hand.
Yeah, you know, I'd grown up listening to the Stooges, and I had all this stuff.
At this point, you had never played outside of your town.
No, well, I think I'd played in Nashville once or twice, but that was
it. Band went over to Nashville.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but no, I'd never been outside of Tennessee. Or
okay.
Anything. So, yes, I mean, I saw that, and I realized completely, like, what a mess this was, and at least in my mind.
I'm gonna do something about it.
Yeah, and he also
maybe help myself.
Well, he also spent that show yelling at that guy too, and really you could tell he was not happy and not satisfied with what it was, and I couldn't help but I had this epiphany, you know, sitting there in that chair, where I realized that I know how to do this. I can fix this situation. I sat there naively thinking, like, this is what I should do. This is what I have to do. I have to go with him.
By this time, you're getting personalities of drummers. And you know Stooges.
Yeah, yeah.
So what'd you think of Scotty?
Well, I mean,
Scotty,
I mean, for me, I guess, you know, in those days, honestly, I was listening mostly to just Iggy. I was listening to the Stooges and Iggy's solo records. Yeah. I knew the whole book. I knew all the stuff. And
those drummers on the solo albums are much different than Scotty's.
Yeah, but Hunt, I totally understood.
Okay.
I mean, Hunt, I latched on to quite a lot,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I listened to a lot of big band stuff and a lot of jazz players, a lot of jazz drummers, and Hunt was, and a lot of soul drummers, and to me, Hunt was like a perfect you know, combination of soul drumming and big band jazz drumming, and he really is a great drummer, and I understood his style completely, and I understood Scotty's style completely, and those guys were really, really in my blood, you know, and I really understood this stuff, and so I thought what I was thinking in my mind, I guess, was I was thinking Iggy needs that. He needs that. He needs someone who understands Scotty and Hunt, you know. That's the thing. Someone who can bridge the Stooges with his solo career. And I thought, I can do that. I know this. And so we drove to Nashville and saw them play again, and it was the same scenario, and I was confirmed in my mind, like, that's
shorter drive.
Well, we were driving back towards Knoxville. It's a 9-hour drive from Memphis to Knoxville.
Oh, man, you know what? We're at the end of the first hour.
Yeah.
July 5, 2011, Watt from Pedro Show. Hold tight for hour two. July 5th, 2011, it's second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Watt from Pedro show started the second hour off with something from my Sonia de Marinaio bandmate Stefano Paglia, who's living in Bologna. And that was Oblivion Part 2 from his band Three Quarters Had Been Eliminated. Which is kind of heavy, you know, for a band.
Yeah.
Somebody was left to finish the album.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we heard Don't Miss the Boat by Keyboard Money Mark. And I was telling you, we got a project called, well, maybe I didn't finish, but it's called Those Punkin' Heads. And a cat named John Wicks on the drums. And Raymond rapping.
Uh-huh.
Raymond Pettibone. Yeah, so Money Mark's getting that all together. Yeah. All
right.
But I did. I came in with bass lines, songs written on the bass, and then the drummy came on, and then Money Mark, and then Raymond.
Wow.
So it's a trippy thing.
That's interesting.
And then we heard the 68th paragraph by Polarity Taskmasters. That was recorded by buddy of Nels's. He's an organ player. I want to get his name right. Wayne Pete. I even got to record in his pad once. With flute player Emily Hay, keyboard Motoko Honda. Yeah, good cats. Oh, yeah, and Brad Dutz. well, it's important. He's a percussion guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Ain't going to discount that. Yeah. But some good stuff. Back this story. You go see Ig, a holler at a drummer in Nashville now.
Well, yeah, we saw the second show, and I was sort of confirmed in my mind that, you know, like, this was
I gotta fix this
is a problem that I have to fix.
Ig deserves it.
Yeah. And you know, at this point, I think I was 17 or 18 years old.
Yeah.
And anyway, we drove back to Knoxville, and I just had, you know, a bug in my brain, you know. I was like, I know what I have to do. And so I did a little research and found, like, the rest of his tour dates. And I noticed that they were touring with the Pretenders. So that meant they had a bunch of shows in Ohio. And
where
I thought,
from, you know,
yeah, and I thought, well, that's not that far away. And at the time I owned a 63 Chevy Nova station wagon.
Yeah.
And so what I decided I was going to do was I put my drums in the back of the station wagon. Yep, there. I put my drums in the back of the station wagon.
Yeah.
And I packed a little bag and I drove to Ohio from Knoxville.
Yeah.
And I got up there to the first show, you know, and what I had done was basically I'd made a bunch of cassette tapes of stuff that I'd recorded of me playing. And then I wrote, like, some handwritten letters to Iggy, kind of telling him about, like, who I was and what I've done and what I wanted to do and how I felt about what I saw on stage with this show.
Right.
And they were really...
Reporter's opinion.
Yeah, well, they were really sincere and very...
Because, what, you're talking 17, 18 years old, right?
Yeah, I mean, they were sincere and obviously very naive, you know, but I honestly believed that, based off the interviews I'd read with him, that he would understand this stuff, what I was saying, and that it would make sense to him.
You might have been a little naive, too.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
That's
I
what I'm saying.
Said they.
No. My writing, my whole dream, sure. My dream was naive. You know, the whole thing was incredibly crazy and naive, you know, but I believed it 100%.
Yeah. I was twisting in my head like, whoa.
Yeah, no, how could I be thinking this? But anyway, I was thinking this.
Sometimes it takes balls like church bells.
Yeah, well, I figured, what have I got to lose? So I went into the venue.
Getting the pound down from Mr. Luna.
I bought my ticket, went in the venue, and I marched right up first, and I marched right up to the stage and gave my little envelopes to his stage crew, same guys that are working with us right now. So, I gave those envelopes to them, and I thought, well, that's that. And then, of course, nothing happened. I watched the show. It was same feelings that I had. Next show was, I don't know, 100 miles away. I drove to that show. I slept in my car, in the front seat of my car, and drove to the next show and did the same
now
thing.
Now you got the drums because you're going to be ready when they get the GO. You're going to get the GO.
Now, when I'm talking about naive, I said my letter, like, if you don't believe me, I've got my drums in the back of the car. And I said, if you want, I'll set them up out in the parking lot here and I'll show you that I'm right. That's how that's how naive I was. I mean, but
kind of naive, but in a way, at least you were ready.
I was.
You know what I mean?
I was ready.
Another dude might be just words.
I was ready to back it up.
Yeah. So
I mean, in my mind,
that ain't total naive.
In my mind, I thought if I get a chance to show him, then I'm just leaving my car here somewhere in Ohio and I'm on the road with him forever. You know, I was just going for it. So, because
a real idiot would, you know, not even know how to play. He'll just like me. See,
I mean,
so I think you had
well, of course,
kind of a thing.
But I could have been wrong. But in my mind, I thought I was right. You know, I thought I really do know how to do this.
If he hears it, he'll know.
Yeah, that's honestly what I thought. Anyway, so I went and did the same thing.
There's nothing jive in that. That's what I'm saying. I think it's got integrity.
Well, I mean, everything I wrote him, you know, I was being just, you know, painfully honest about me and him, and I think. You know, I think he probably sensed that. But anyway, the next show, you know, I did the same thing. I gave these letters again to same roadies. And I also gave one to his bus driver that I saw out in the parking lot. You know, I was making multiple copies of these things. And I was going for it, you know. Nothing happens.
What's on the tape?
The tape is just like recordings of me.
By yourself, though?
Some by myself, maybe a couple with some bands, you know, whatever. Whatever I had in those days.
Like examples of your
prowess. It's the best I could come up with. You know, I had to do something. So, you know, I went to some more shows. I don't know how many. I might have done five shows or maybe a whole week of shows. I was living in my car. And, you know, nothing was happening. You know, I wasn't getting any reactions. I was giving my packages every show to these roadies and you know, just thinking, well, sooner or later, one of these things has got to get in his hands, and he'll probably like open it up and read this, you know. So after a week of this,
well, maybe you might have been thinking, maybe he ain't getting them.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
They're probably tossing them in the garbage. Who knows what? But I figure at some point he's going to hear about this and open one of these things up and read it. So after about a week. You know, I knew it by this point, watching the show all week long, I had the show already memorized. You know, I knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And every show, he would do a breakdown in TVI and sort of talk about the daily news or something, whatever, some
topical
stream of consciousness kind of delivery. And it was always interesting. And
kind of the rap.
Yeah. And this night, all of a sudden, he started talking about growing up in a small town and having a vision to get out of the town and being held back by the constraints of being in the South and not understanding how to get. He started talking about everything that I was writing him about.
So you could tell that he
read. And I was like, holy shit, he's read my letter. He got it.
Actually, Knoxville is the big town. What's your hometown?
Knoxville. Well, I come from Sevierville, just outside of Knoxville. Yeah.
You should get that straight, though, because there's some people back there who might...
Well, Sevierville...
Oh, be proud of him.
Well, I actually grew up in Seymour, you know, but that's just next to... That's in between Sevierville and Knoxville, you know, and Sevierville's where Dolly Parton and Cormac McCarthy has come out of. And
cool.
So those are my roots there.
See, there can be a small town, but there can always be a small town.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got villages and then, you know, everything. But
back to Hank and his rap.
Well, you know.
The rap confirms to you it got through.
Yeah, he was talking about everything that I was trying to tell him, which is I'm trying to get out of this bubble. And I know that I deserve to be out of this bubble. And he was saying like
Woodsburg.
Well, he was saying like sometimes the only thing you've got, if you got nothing, sometimes the only thing you can do is just get in your car and drive after what you want. You know, you have to get in it and you have to go after what you believe in. You have to not be afraid to go after what you want, your dream. You know, and that's exactly what I was writing him. And I was like, and I was sitting there watching that, thinking, God Almighty, Like he got it.
It didn't get tossed.
Yeah, I was like, I thought I did it. I made this connection, yeah. And that was kind of like the only thing I figured. Well, that's as far as this is going to go. I'm gonna leave. I'm gonna go home. This is as far as this is going to go. I can't. I was out of money and I was tired and I just wanted to go home. And I turned around and standing there behind me,
I was a tarred man. we're starting to go to punk shows. Mm.
Well, I
had no idea. I did say to D. Boone, when we saw the first one, I said, we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I was kind of empowered, but I didn't have the balls. Like.
Well, I turned around, and standing there behind me was his chief roadie, Joss, who you and I both know very well now. And Joss was standing right behind me, and I recognized him. And he had found me in a crowd of about 4,000 or 5,000 people, which I immediately understood. I understood, like, oh, he's found me. And he basically, in so many short words, told me to get lost, and he didn't want to see me anymore. And told me that I was doing this the wrong way, and just disappear. And so I told him, there's no hard feelings. I am leaving, and I was going to leave, and there's nothing, nothing to be worried about. Nothing to be worried about. You know, of course, Joss, as you know, is a very physically fit man. So I made my way back to Knoxville, and I thought, well, I did it. I made my connection.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the main thing I was trying to do. I was reaching out.
Yeah.
I was reaching outside of my bubble, outside of my zone. And I realized, like, the main thing about this was that I realized that money or talent is not necessarily going to get me out of here, but writing could possibly get me out of here. So I thought I should write.
Writing letters,
because yeah. I'm good at that. And I thought I should write more people. Write some more people that...
Solicitor.
Yeah. I should write more people some personal letters. Yeah. That musicians that I like or people that I thought I could work with or that I understood.
Put your stuff... Say you're available.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Say I'm trying to get out. I mean, of course, I was 17.
Yeah,
I was like,
I'm available.
Yeah, yeah. So, I made me a little list of people to write to. So I wrote to Adrian Ballou. And that also led to going to Ohio. He was living in Cincinnati at that time. And
he's from Champaign originally.
Well, his manager actually contacted me, invited me to come up there and meet with him. So I did. I drove up there and met with him. I met with his manager, but he had a band going on at that time called The Bears.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was with all his high school buddies, and basically nothing was going to interrupt that. So I realized that wasn't going anywhere. So I came back, and I wrote XTC in England. Of course nothing happened there, and then the other person I wrote was Greg Ginn from Black Flag. So I sent him a letter, same thing, told him I was thinking about moving to New York or moving to Los Angeles, and I was like, I don't know which one it's going to be, but anyway, I just want to, I'm trying, and here's some, if you want to listen to this stuff that I'm doing, this is some stuff. And I think he actually listened to this stuff. And
they weren't just letters. The cassettes were with these things, too.
Yeah, everything had cassettes. Yeah. Okay. Back in those days, we had cassettes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it wasn't just letters. It wasn't just the words.
Yeah, no. It had music.
It also had music.
So I think Greg actually listened to this stuff. Because, as you know, Greg listens to everything.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
Anyway, so he...
And he's into, it was... Our second gig, he said, you want to be OO2. He's into going for it.
Yeah. Well, he's...
You know what I mean?
He's not afraid to take chances.
That's what I mean.
I think that's why...
We weren't even together at all. We had a polka drummer. We didn't just start, and he said, you want to be OO2.
Well, I think that's why...
He balls out, man.
I think he read my thing and listened to my thing, and I think he took it dead serious. And at the time, I was painting houses to save up money to move out of Tennessee. Yeah. And I was up on a ladder painting the side of a house, and the guy who owned the house said, look, you got a phone call here. I think it's important. So he passed me the phone up on the ladder. It had come from, I guess my parents had given him the number where I was. He was really tracking me down.
Yeah.
And so I answered the phone, and it's, hi, this is Greg Ginn. And I almost fell off the ladder. I was like, oh my God, really? What? And he's like, look, I got your letter here and your tapes. I've been listening to this stuff and I really like it. And I really, I want to help you get out here. I said, well, great. You know, I'll be out there, you know, this summer. And he was like, well, what would it take for you to come out here like now? Because I'd like to do something with you right now. And I said, well, I don't know. I'm just trying to save up money, really, to drive across the United States. And he's like, well, what do you need? I said, just gas money, really. So he's like, well, I'm going to wire that to you right now. So he wired me some gas money.
Yeah.
And I had to pretty much drive around town that afternoon and tell all my friends goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, this is it. I'm leaving and I'm not coming back. And I got one friend who jumped in the car with me to go the next morning. And
I don't want to come back either.
Yeah, rest his soul. That guy's name was Bonehead. He was
shit.
Did you know? You remember
he
Bonehead?
He was a dorm. He worked at that Vic and Bill.
Oh yeah, you remember? He was a big guy with a big mohawk. Well, Bonehead, he's passed away, right? A couple of months
ago. Yeah, somebody told me that.
And anyway, he jumped in the car with me, and I was going to drive across alone, and so I put
Vic and Bill's. You guys got to know about this. There was a deli. This is where the Minutemen first played Knoxville.
Yep, yep.
In front of gold cases and shit.
Yeah.
The only thing, I mean, this is a frat school.
Hoagies.
Yeah, a frat town in a way, as far as.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
it's a college town.
People who've come of age and stuff, go back to Boy Scouts and become frat boys.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of tough. And the punk scene there was. It was tough to be one, I think.
This
is my experience being a guy who's torn around in different towns. And people, it wasn't gratuitous. You wanted to be a punk, you had to work at it in that town.
Yeah.
And I dug that gig, and this is where I met Camp Childers,
Camp.
Okay, a little side note there, this was a great gig for us.
And, yeah. Well, Bonehead was like an institution of that city. He was a punk
rock. He got in the boat with you, though.
Yeah, which was a blessing for me, because I was going to drive all the way to Los Angeles with everything that I owned in the back of my car, without a gun. And, you know, with no money and et cetera, alone. And that's a long ways to go as a kid.
Yeah.
Anyway, I had Bonehead with me. And as you may recall, he was a very big guy. He was a really big, part Cherokee Indian with a huge, full-size mohawk. Really intimidating-looking figure. So he was my passenger. And
this is 1987.
Yeah. And
so we had already played.
Yeah. So,
Yeah, a couple of years before.
Yeah, yeah. So we took off driving. You know, I blew a piston in Arkansas outside of Memphis. I had to get that repaired. Spent all my money on that, but we kept going.
Damn, you weren't even out of Tennessee yet.
Yeah, no. You know, we were determined, but he and I, you know, we were sleeping in the car. You know, having shower. You know, every town. You know, in the morning we'd go find a motel with a swimming pool outside and jump in the pool for a shower, and then get back and keep driving. You know, we drove all the way across the United States like that.
Yeah.
And you know, he'd sleep on the top of the car like a beached whale, and I'd sleep in the front seat. You know, and all my stuff was
George
in the back.
Used to sleep on the roof of the boat.
Yeah. So you know, it was like that.
Me, I am a wild. That's why I don't use a bed. I use the deck because I roll around. I'd fucking break my neck for sure if I tried.
We had incredible times.
How long did it take? 4 days? 3 days?
I think we spent about a week driving across.
A week?
Yeah,
wow.
Or 5 days. I remember we stopped outside of Dallas somewhere. He was always picky about where we were going to sleep. And he would we'd drive around looking for a cool place to park and sleep. And we found a baseball field one time outside of Dallas, and he's like, oh, this is going to be great. Let's sleep at the baseball field. You sleep. He's like, that's it. You sleep in the front seat, and I'm going to go sleep on the pitcher's mound in a sleeping bag. So he went out.
What? Fucking phone don't work.
Yeah. So anyway.
Oh. Sorry, people.
Oh, we got the headquarters here.
Well, that stopped.
Well, you know, so he got it.
Bullshit.
Good old Bonehead. He went out and I slept in the car, and he went out and set up his sleeping bag on the pitcher.
No, but I'm thinking of the mountain, you know, because the easiest way, you know this now after touring, is I-40. What you should have done was.
We drove across Texas.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's a part of Texas you want to do is the Panhandle, Amarillo, I-40.
We did the low road. which is
a lot more miles.
That's Texas, Oklahoma, and all the way to Arizona.
Yeah, I know exactly how it is.
Yeah, yeah. No, not Oklahoma. There was no Oklahoma.
You did I-10.
Yeah, we did Arkansas, Texas.
Look, there's something about, we're doing a radio show right now. When you ain't shot, we heard Steve McKay on the phone. Thank you so much. There's something about my phone. I try to answer the fucker and it don't ring.
Toby Dallin.
Yeah, we ain't really doing a shout. We're doing a radio show.
Okay.
And I had to coat my window because I can't stand air
punch. Anyway, this is the boss.
Thank you so much. That's my coat. Henry, you're beautiful. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
All right. So anyway, we made it to
so
California.
You went, and what time of year was this?
The summer. Yeah, yeah.
You took the roaster route.
Yeah, we took the roaster route.
So you did like El Paso and...
Yeah, we went all through Arizona, and we finally got to Southern California, and then I moved in with Greg.
Oh,
and so I moved in with Greg, and there in Lawndale, and, Greg put it together. Yeah. And, we started rehearsing, and... started this whole thing going, and we never did get a band together. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, we never did get a band together, but anyway, he was really supportive and kind of.
What you did was, I can enlighten you people a little bit. He probably did some 8-hour jams.
Yeah, yeah, as soon as I got there, he's like, "Well, tomorrow we're going to jam," and then we went to a rehearsal space.
Yeah, you got to describe what that was like.
Well, we went into a punk rock rehearsal space,
mm-hmm.
and we sat up and we jammed for about 8 hours or something like that, all day long, really really heavy, and
right.
And then, went back.
Come home and he'd listen.
Come back and he'd stay up all night listening to what we did all day. And the next morning we'd get up and he wanted to go do it again.
Right.
And so we did this night and day, night and day, night and day for, I don't know, 10 days or 2 weeks or something. And, and I was pretty exhausted. I was out of money and really, really tired and trying to figure out, where is this going, And it seemed clear at a certain point that we weren't going to get anybody else to work with. And I just got frustrated with the whole thing and just sort of moved out.
Yeah.
And I moved up to Hollywood, and I wound up...
Almost the best move.
Yeah. I wound up moving in with this band, Tex and the Horseheads.
Yeah.
And I wound up
playing... Mike Mark, good buddy of mine.
Well,
he's originally from Long Beach.
Well,
that's trippy.
At that time, Dave Catching was playing guitar in the band.
Oh, really? I remember that.
And now Dave plays in the Eagles of Death Metal and used to be in the Queens of the Stone Age. And anyway, we all wound up living together. And
you're in the trippy days of them.
Yeah, I did that for a year with those guys and kind of moved out of that. And then I wound up becoming good friends with Paul Rossler there,
Paul's Kay's brother.
Yeah.
I had a band with him called Criminy. We played some Criminy on the show. It was just piano and bass for some time I ever played with the piano. No, really? Second, in high school,
uh-huh.
Somebody asked me to play bass. The best bass player at our school wanted to play piano at the talent show for a Stevie Wonder cover. And I'd never done anything like that, and I played this, and the bass line was like boom. Boom, boom,
mm-hmm.
boom, the kick drum pattern.
Well, now, I've known about
Paul. Did you know about him?
Well, I knew about
Screamers.
Him. First time I ever
45 grade.
First time I ever laid eyes on Paul was with the SST operation coming into Knoxville with the rat van coming with the rider
truck. So
probably
DC-3.
Yeah, it was DC-3, and
play bass parts on the organ.
Yep, and the rat rider truck had backed up to the venue and
they carried their own PA.
Yeah, it was their old PA there, and that was where.
You know
I
about Dave now?
Yeah.
18 semi trucks. You would not believe the company.
Well, I would believe it after how hard I saw him working when I met him. But
respect.
But the first time I ever saw Paul was the Black Flag truck had pulled up. It was the Rat PA truck, and they Dave got out from behind the driver's wheel and came
Brian,
around back and
his partner Brian.
Yeah, yeah, and they rolled up the back of the truck and Paul Rossler crawled out from on top of the PA. With his 6-foot-long dreadlocks.
And Hank used to be back there till some scary thing with Dave on, like, I'm never riding back there.
Well, Paul was doing it. Anyway, so that was my first.
Somebody had to do it.
That was my first vision.
Trailer ballast.
Of Paul, and I thought, wow, yeah. These guys are intense. And But of course,
which was trippy because Paul, one of the few Hollywood guys from the Hollywood scene that transferred over.
Yeah.
Like Hollywood people would consider too sissy.
Yeah.
But Paul did it.
Well, he went.
Respect to Paul.
He went from working with Nina Hagen to that. You know?
But before and that, so, he was a screamer.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, you know, he'd been in Berlin and he'd been around the world, and
that's
you know,
right.
He
that's
knew a
right.
thing or two, and he was doing that.
And he went and, back to her.
Yeah, I know. He played on her last record actually, but anyway, you know, of course DC3 were great. So I knew about him, and so.
Damn, who was the drummy? I think the drummy died.
Yeah, he did. That was Louie.
Louis.
Yeah. And
he was a nice cat.
Yeah, I remember him. And he was playing with Tex. He was playing with Tex before before I started.
Yeah.
And
you were in a weird mode of Tex's band. Now
I'm
thinking about
it. Was a lot of lot of transition going on. A lot of people coming and going.
She's better now though, you know.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah. You know, but a lot of people hanging out. Keith Morris was at every one of our shows, and he was real supportive of me, and he and I became really good friends at that time. And anyway, you know, so I wound up in this thing with Paul, and that was kind of going on for a year. And it was kind of, you know, we weren't really doing that much. We played some shows.
He had a weird thing with Mark Curry.
No, this was before.
Before that
yeah. We were calling it Twisted Roots at the time.
Yeah,
she had this band, Twisted Roots.
Sure, that goes way back with
and
his
then,
sister.
And then I talked him into changing the name of the band to a Jim Dandy thing that I knew about, and we changed the name of the band to the Halls of Karma.
Yeah, I remember that.
He loved the name, so he changed it.
So you were part of that.
Yeah, and I was staying at Paul's house and all kinds of stuff like that. But anyway. You know, that wasn't really it wasn't really going anywhere, and I had plans to move up to the Bay Area and just like get out of music altogether. I was just sick of everything, and one night I was out at a bar, and there was a kid who was coming to a lot of these shows with Paul, and he was a guitarist. His name was Whitey Kirst, and he was coming, and he was kind of a fan. He's from Calgary. He was a fan, and. He was always trying to set up jam sessions with me, and you know, one night I'd been out at a bar, and I saw on a television on a David Letterman show, Iggy was on the show, and David was asking him questions, and one of the questions was, "Look, you know, I see you always, you know, have different musicians on your records, and how do you find these guys? How do you find these musicians? Do you put an ad out in the paper, or what do you do?" And Iggy was sort of laughing the whole thing off, but he proceeded to sort of tell him the whole story about me following him around in Ohio. And
how many years ago now is this?
That had been a couple, 2 or 3 years.
Still kind of recent.
Yeah, and I thought, I mean, of course, my jaw dropped when he started telling the story, but then afterwards I realized, like, wow, like, I made a real impression with him. He remembers
this. Right, it wasn't just a spiel in TV.
No, he really remembers this.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that was something real. Anyway, so shortly after that,
that's cool.
This kid Whitey, he's telling me at a bar, he's like, look, I got an audition tomorrow with this guy, some singer. His name's Iggy Pop. Have you ever heard of him? And I said,
you know, I heard this about Whitey too. Like Whitey didn't know who he was.
He didn't know anything about him, and he was friends with his son. And I was like, you have an audition tomorrow with Iggy Pop? And you don't know who he is? He's like, no. And I said, well, and I told him some stuff about Iggy. But then I also told him...
Ain't that a trip?
Yeah, I told him the story. I told him a story about what I'd done, like, several years before in Ohio. And he was like, you know, of course, to him, it was all abstract. He didn't know who any of this stuff was. And I said, look, you know, if you get a chance to talk to him, you should tell him you know the guy who did that, you know, because he'd probably laugh and, you know, take some pressure off the situation and give you something to talk about. Well, the next day, I went home from work.
You know where you were at when you were cocking at Paul's? That's called Walteria.
It was Torrance.
It's actually called Walteria. It's a little section of Torrance between there. It's part of Torrance.
Yeah.
But it's got... What they do when they make track homes, they give these things names.
Yeah.
You know, to sell them, and they call that part Walteria. It's between it's the north side of Palos Verdes, Rolling Hills, and Torrance. South High was right across the PCH.
Yeah.
The big road near you was Pacific Coast Highway.
Yeah.
And he's not in Hollywood, people. This is like about 27 miles south.
Yeah.
So I can imagine you wanting...
Down in the petroleum
I got to do something.
Yeah, the petroleum
factories. It's track homes and... Actually, it was kind of good for him because that scene was rough, but some of the scene we could do inside that. But actually, it was kind of close to Pedro. You weren't that far from me at that time.
Well, one time with that band, we did play in Pedro. We did at some party, someone's house in the backyard.
Okay, so you were in my town.
Yeah.
All right.
I was there once. Next,
back to Whitey.
The next day, you know, after this thing, I come home from work and I check my answer machine, and there's a message on there from Iggy. And it's him talking.
Oh, he gave the number.
Yeah. I said, yeah, well, he had my phone number. So I guess he must have asked, give me that guy's phone number.
Yeah.
So he called me, left me a message, and I heard this message, and he's asking me to call him back at his hotel, and I thought, this is a trick, and this is not real. This guy's playing a trick on me, you know. These guys are going to have a big laugh.
You couldn't hear his voice?
No, I heard his voice, but I thought, this is someone playing a joke on me. It can't be real.
Doing fake voice.
Yeah, they're going to get a big laugh on this one. But I figured, well, I wrote the number down, and I figured, well, I better just call this and just, you know, see what it is. And I called it, and it was the hotel that he had said it was. And I said, yeah, I'm calling this guy in this room here, and they put me through, and Iggy answered the phone. And of course, I was beside myself at that point, you know. And he said, look, I got your number from this guy, you know, this guitar player, and I really want you to come down tomorrow. We got a place where we can jam, and I'm trying to put a new band together, and I want you to come down and do it and just see how it goes. And I was like, okay, I'll be there tomorrow. So I went down there, and I did my best, and of course I knew all the stuff, and it went really, really well. And after the thing, you know, we talked a little bit, and he pretty much just said, like, this is the way it's going to be. You know, I want this to be the band, and I want you to be the drummer, and, you know, it's going to go on.
Who's Basie?
There's a fellow named Craig Pike, who was playing in a band with Whitey at that time. Mm-hmm. So that was the audition, was the three of us. And he was like, look, we're just going to leave it like this. This is what it's going to be if you guys are all right. And we all said yes. And, you know, we pretty much, you know, said, cool, you know, that's it. We're going to do it. And then I wound up, like, working with him every day for the next 9 years. And, you know, we became very, very close. And, you know, I mean,
you still ended up moving to the Bay Area.
Yeah. It didn't really matter where I lived. I mean,
were long tours, people.
The first thing we did was a
year and a halfers.
The first tour we did was a year. And that was quite a shock for me because, well, I mean, I didn't really have anywhere to live, but at that point I didn't need anywhere to live.
Right,
so I put everything in storage and we went on the road for a year. And played a lot, went all over the place. I mean, most of the tour was outside of the United States. You know, but we came back and we took a little break. We restructured the band and got new guitar player and bass player and mounted that new thing, made a new record, and went on the road for 18 months.
You know, when you saw him before in the... I wanted to ask you this by spaced, which I hardly do. but was Dougie Baum in one of those bands?
No, Dougie played with
him. That's post-Dougie, okay.
Dougie played with him, I think, around 82, or 81 or 82. Dougie played on Party.
I actually got to record with him when he was with Chris Whitley.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
Chris
Whitley. I made one record with Chris Whitley, too. Yeah,
I only got to record on one song. It was in Oxnard. He was beautiful.
He was a great guy.
Great singer, great player, and a person.
Really, really great guy.
People, he died early.
Yeah, too early, that's for sure.
He's kind of a blues man.
He was a great blues man. Yeah, he was more than a blues man. Yeah. He was a great slide player.
I'm not talking affected with capital or small A. I mean, he was a blues man.
You know about his daughter, right?
Belgian mother or something?
Well, she's a singer. She's got a band with Daniel Lanois right now.
Is that right?
Yeah, called Black Dub, and they're really great.
Okay.
She's a young girl, but she's really, really a great... She's an incredible singer. The talent has definitely passed down.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
He was always...
It's her and Daniel Lanois and Brian Blade.
Wow.
Yeah.
He would always talk about her. He was great. I miss Chris.
Yeah.
And he played on one of my records, one song, a Blue Oyster Cult song, doing Slide, Dominance and Submission.
Yeah. Well, now the fellow who produced his first record, they made that record, was Daniel Lanois and Malcolm Byrne. That's the guy who produced this Chloe Moms record.
You know what? He didn't like that first record.
Oh, he didn't like it?
No, he thought it was Mersch.
Oh, wow.
He liked the months after the kind of meat puppet thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The record company did not dig that. Or an A&R or something.
Yeah. Well, he moved around.
550 Death Stuff.
I know he got tossed around with the labels. I know he moved around. Yeah,
but you know what? But that's my Dougie. I'm wondering where Dougie was in the thing. I first saw him with John Cale. And I know he went on to Lounge Lizards and that.
Right.
But back to this. You're doing 9 years of touring with Ig.
It was 9 years of hard work. Yeah, we made several records. We worked on a film together. That was a huge project. That was a big part of our relationship. I think was this we did a film score with Johnny Depp for a film Johnny Depp made called The Brave. It was Johnny's first written and directed film. Mm-hmm. And Iggy and I did that together, and we worked really, really hard on that project together. That was interesting.
Which albums did you record with him?
American Caesar. And then it was, Naughty Little Doggy and Avenue B, these records. And, the movie was sort of the most interesting thing we ever did because that was without a band.
Yeah.
It was really just me and him, and it was a much more personal project.
What town?
Los Angeles.
Okay.
I wound up staying in LA for 3 months working on that. And,
wow.
We were working really closely with Johnny, and it was really an earnest project. It was really, we were all working very hard on that. It was great. It's the best thing we did together, I think.
Was that in the middle of the tour? Of the nine?
I was around 94, 95 or somewhere.
Yeah, so it's kind of
somewhere
in the middle of it.
Yeah, somewhere around
there. So after the movie, you went back to the...
And
changes in the band.
We changed guitar players and bass players, and I started working with a lot of different bands in that time.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, I joined this band Swans.
Oh, that's
from
right.
New York. And
Had moved to New York?
No, I was still living in San Francisco. Actually,
just playing with him.
Yeah, I was playing with him. Actually, at that point. Well, I'd become really close friends with Michael because I was spending so much time in New York. When I would come to
Zig
New York,
Zig was living in New York.
Yeah, so whenever we would rehearse and organize anything, it was done in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be there, and Michael kind of became my best friend in New York. So when I would get into town, I would call him.
Yeah.
And so I would do my work, and then at night I'd go out with Michael drinking beer and talking about music and life and everything else. And he became like my best friend there, and. He actually...
I didn't see him in that period. I saw Swans in the 80s.
Yeah, I actually got him to come to San Francisco. And, he got a new manager.
He had a band in the old days that played our scene. Maybe it was called the Strict IDs or the Cripples or...
Now those I don't know.
You know about this?
I don't
before
know.
Before he went to New York,
oh, yeah, before,
he
yeah.
had a band. I can't remember the name. Because he's from the Hill.
Yeah.
Such a trip.
Yeah.
You got him to come to SF?
Yeah, he came there, and we actually kind of put it in.
Oh, but you got to meet some SF people, too, during this time.
Well, yeah.
It wasn't just Suitcase. You got to actually meet, residents?
Well, the Cryptic Corporation.
Yeah.
I got involved with the Cryptic Corporation. But,
How'd that happen? In between making movies and touring with Big.
Well, that happened, I don't know, it was an odd thing. Like, one of the people that were working for the Cryptic Corporation, the residents were organizing a new record at that time. It was a musical, and it was a musical that they were constructing about stories from the Bible. And what they were doing...
Oh, this might be after Ig, then. This is early 2000s?
No, it was in the 90s.
It was?
Yeah, and...
Because me and Raymond saw this. My memory is so terrible.
Well, the tour came later, but the record was...
Oh, that's why.
The record was interesting. You know, what they would do is they would just hire, like, lots of singers. They would get different characters for all their songs.
Yeah.
And so they'd have different characters come in and sing. And they... the Cryptic Corporation asked me to come in and as a singer, as a vocalist. They wanted me to play the part of
Jesus. Yeah, how'd you meet him?
As Jesus Christ.
They're so cryptic. you wrote him a letter and said
no,
a cassette?
No. One of the people that were working on the project, she knew me and had recommended me as a potential character. And
potential character.
So I came in. They asked me to be Jesus Christ.
Of course.
So I came in.
What else?
And so they had these songs for me to sing, and It was pretty tough roll, you know, because the song.
Who was the one in the, what's his name, Weber?
Weber?
It was Ian Gillan, the Deep Purple guy.
No, I don't know.
Da, 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 da.
Oh, the Jesus Christ Superstar? Oh.
And he was a Deep Purple singer.
Right. Well, now, we weren't doing Jesus Christ Superstar.
I know. I'm just trying to, like, parallel you.
We were doing customized interpretations.
Oh, they're trippers. Yeah. Like me and Raymond saw it.
Yeah. And so, the songs...
House It Blue.
Yeah, well, the songs that... Actually, the Jesus Christ songs didn't actually make the record for one reason or another.
State Old Testament.
Well, I think the songs may have been potentially just too... shocking. The lyrical content was so, I have to say, I mean, when I saw the lyrics and what I was going to, and it was interesting because they knew I was from Tennessee, so they asked me to sing in this sort of like Bill Monroe kind of little boy falsetto voice, kind of hillbilly falsetto. And the lyrics were particularly vulgar and like particularly crass, like really, really bad.
Right.
And it was all the songs were dealing with the Book of Revelations and the end of the world, and it was really amazing writing, and so I did all that. I tracked all those.
They were Louisiana.
They're from
deeper than you.
So you know the writing was amazing. Anyway, so. It was a great experience. It was funny. I was getting married at that time, and all that session took place the day before I got married in San Francisco. I was living in New York at that time. But anyway, you know, I mean, Cryptic stayed in touch with me. You know, they got the record organized and out, and then this person who had recommended me to do the thing had, at a certain point, I guess they needed some kind of drumming on some stuff, and at a certain point she had said, well, you know what he's a drummer.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, well, that's perfect. So so Cryptic got me involved in doing that. So I became more and more deeply involved in what they were doing instrumentally. And it was
you met Eric Drew Feldman on a bus.
I met Eric Drew Feldman on a city bus in San Francisco because at the time we were both living on Haight Street. And so I think we were both just going home.
Look, we got the end of the second hour here.
Oh, God. All right.
Feels flying.
Thank God you have a long
hold tight. It's the July 5, 2011 Watt from Pedro show. Hang tight for more from Sir Larry. Hour 3. July 5th, 2011. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro show.
Watt from Pedro Show, third hour, started off with Hope from Boris. Yeah, while you guys were listening to that, Mr. Larry, we were talking about Hope via music. And then we heard Green Rain by Shugo Tokumaru. And then I'm Getting Sick of You by Les Butcherettes.
It's got a wild drummy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Beetroot. It's just this Italian band, Beetroot. Maybe they're not. Yeah, they are. In fact, but they got the guy from International Noise Conspiracy singing with them, Dennis.
Okay.
But this cat, he had a San Diego band called Locust.
Oh, yeah.
Wild drummer. And he's playing with this lady named Terry.
Yeah.
Now, Terry was born in Colorado, but grew up in Mexico. I got to do some gigs with her. She's incredible. She plays with a butcher smock on, you know.
Oh, really?
She does guitar, organs, and sings, and she's so intense. She's great. And Les Butcherettes.
Okay.
Jonathan, the bass man, just a trio. And then Witch of Endor, which is from Hobo Combo, which was it's a tribute band to Moondog.
Oh, nice.
And this cat, the drummer man, is Andrea Belfi. And Andrea Belfi is... remember at the beginning of the show I played Stefano Palia? Okay, this is the drummer man for El Sueño de Manayo, the band I have with these two Italian guys. And Andrea Belfi lives in Berlin.
Oh.
And he's just doing a residency for a skateboard company. Oh, but putting on music and, you know, so chasing his thing. I remember having them on the show when I did a tour with them, 6 gigs, and then we made an album. That's going to be out in the fall. And maybe they're 20 years younger than me. But I got into this having them on the show so they could talk about their journey through music.
Yeah.
And some of the first things he said he heard was Green Day. And then we went to some music and he said, man, kind of a little embarrassing. I'm like, but Green Day. I said, look, man, everybody's got different ways of coming in stuff. Yeah, don't worry.
So did they talk much about Moondog? Did they know much about Moondog?
This whole record's about it.
Okay, really?
Yeah, yeah. It's called Hobo Combo. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe he might live close to where you do in Berlin. I'll find out.
Well, they never met him, though. They never met him.
No, they're younger people.
Okay.
Because they're these cats, Stefano and Andrea, both... avant-garde. They know lots about music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're not as... thug-like is.
Well, it's funny. You know, like for the last 9 years or so, I've been working with this Swiss singer. His name's Stefan Eicher, and he is the godson of Moondog. He was very close friends with Moondog.
So I got to put you in touch with him, Dan.
Yeah.
I got this whole album of it. I've played a lot of it on my show and stuff. And Andrea is just more than a drummer. He's a composer too. You know, he's into his kind of soft machine and Robert Wyatt and.
Yeah.
He makes stuff like this. And
Stefan was very close with him, and he actually organized a lot of concerts for Moondog in the latter part of his life. He organized some big full concerts in France and Switzerland, and they were very close. Really fascinating.
The shows
are great. I have these shows.
Wow. Yeah. Well, maybe they'd be interested. I'll flow you the info. Andrea, just recent to Berlin. He's from Verona.
From Verona.
Verona, yeah.
Okay.
He's a great cat, man. Oh. Touring with them guys, they cook for me every day.
Nice.
Had a prac pad was out in the country because you were saying about the Italy thing, but man, well, my mom's people are from there, so I have a little connect.
Okay.
But when I was there, man, the gigs I did and the recording, when I was in the studio, the guys, recording is cooked for me. When I did the radio show in Tuscany with Jacobo, they had some cats play on. Horns on our thing, and we did the radio show. They're cooking.
Well, now
I had more men cooking for me on that tour.
Well, now when I work on records in Berlin, we do a similar thing, but it's a barbecue thing. We've got the studio in my house, and I've got a big place there where we can barbecue. And so, you know, normally if things are going well, if it's going well, then, you know, the engineer, you know, stays with what's going on there, and then I get the grills going, and I get the barbecue. So the end of the session. It's
That's
barbecue
happening.
Time. Yeah, it's very
That's
nice.
Happening.
It's beautiful there.
These cats, they were just, they're really neat. I want to tour with them when this album comes out. Back to the journey.
Well, the journey...
Well, you were talking about the residents and the Bible stories.
Well, and swans.
And now I mean, Michael and yeah, swans.
At a certain point, around there at the end of the 90s, I moved to New York City. And I kept working with Michael. I think I made 7 records with Michael. He decided to shut the Swans down and turn it into this new thing called the Angels of Light.
Yeah.
And so I continued doing that with him. I made some interesting projects in New York. Worked on a few films there. But I had my sights set on moving to Europe, really, and I finally did. I moved over to Berlin, and I moved over about 7 years ago, and in 2000.
So from New York.
From New York.
From Berlin.
And I got over there. I made a record, a duet record with my best buddy over there, with Thomas Wiedler, the drummer from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Yeah.
And he was working with this incredible engineer who I hit it off with, and so there was a band in New York that wanted me to produce a record for them, and they wanted to do like an orchestral record, and I knew that was like financially devastating to try and do something like that in New York City. So I said, look, you know, let's go to Berlin. And
what was your first producing thing?
It was that record, really.
Okay.
I mean, well, I had done one film score in New York.
Not with Egg.
It was my own thing.
No, the Egg one was in L.A.
Yeah, the Egg one was in L.A. But I'd done one in New York where I organized the whole thing and had a 21-piece orchestra.
You knew about the orchestra thing in New York.
Well, yeah. That's where I learned
all. What was his film?
It's a movie called Applejack. And it was pretty.
Applejack is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, it's about this little boy, but anyway, it was like, you know, the director really had some tall dream. You know, he had some really complex dreams about what he wanted. He wanted sort of like, he wanted like a Burbank stage orchestra kind of thing, combined with like hillbilly bluegrass with science fiction space effects and stuff, all this mixed together. So it was a pretty tall order. It was a real complicated thing to try and design, and I did it, but I needed 21 musicians to do it.
Yeah.
And as I was mentioning, to do that in New York City was like a nightmare financially, and I finally got the project done. It took several years, And after that, I just realized, like, you know, it's just too hard to try and mount a production like that in New York. You know, it's just so. Anyway, so they had also, this band had a big production kind of in mind, and I was like, the only way we're really going to be able to do this is to go somewhere else. And so. One of the guys in the group had actually grown up in Berlin, so he was really gung-ho for it. So I took them over there, and we made a record there, and we got over there, we all got apartments, and we all just stayed. We all did. And so I was going back and forth between New York for a few years, and finally the juxtaposition was just too much to take anymore. And finally I closed my studio down in New York, and then I closed my apartment in New York, and I just moved everything.
You had a studio in New York?
Yeah, I had a studio.
I didn't know that.
Had a studio on Mott Street.
Little Italy.
just south of Houston.
Little Italy.
Yeah, very nice there. I was sharing, I was right next door. My neighbors were Blonde Redhead.
We did some gigs with them, the two Italian brothers.
Yeah, yeah. And we
the
were
lady,
down.
The lady had a horse step on her face.
Yeah, well, I think she actually broke a leg.
I think she had some.
Oh, really?
They were telling me. I was doing a gig, and she told me this story, and I was like, oh my God.
She did have a big accident with a horse, I know. But yeah, they were my neighbors. We were down in the basement next to each other, and they liked to work during the day, and I worked during the night. So that's the way we did it.
Wow. And so... In Berlin, you make a studio?
Yeah. Yeah, I have a studio in the house where I live in Berlin. And
Did you get that going right away?
I got it going right away. I mean,
did
basically...
that orchestral thing?
Yeah. This Mel's record here, we did that there. And the first track on that record, which is sort of more of a Turkish kind of thing with a big Turkish orchestra kind of arrangement, I did all that in Berlin. And... It's a really...
Well, what'd you do there? As soon as you got there, of course you did this proj.
Yeah, we finished that record. And then once people found out that I was living there, and there was, you know, there's a lot of people moving there, a lot of people that are coming to Berlin to make projects,
yeah.
You know, because I'm not the only one who came up with this idea. There's people coming from China. People are coming from China and yeah. Italy and Sweden and Argentina and all over the place. People are coming there, and it's an affordable, or it's probably one of the most affordable places to put something together like that. Or if you want to, you know, I know clothing designers and architects and painters and choreographers and, you know, choreographers and, you know, like
choreographers.
Yeah, that's a Tennessee coming out. I know lots of people doing different kinds of things, but people that need some space, you know, if they need big space to design what it is they're going to make.
Yeah.
That's a problem, you know. It's like space is expensive.
Oh, Manhattan. You mean.
Yeah, or in Manhattan, or in Paris, or
yeah,
you
know, big town. Yeah.
So a lot of people are coming there because you can get a big raw space for really cheap.
Right.
And or you can rehearse a band, or you can record a string section, or you can, you know, build a big thing, or you know, put a big ballet together, or whatever. I mean, it's like people can find a way to do it, you know. So. It's an interesting place to be, actually. So it's been really productive for me. I think I've made 10 records there since I've been there. So and I started working more with a lot of French artists. And
but remember what you were saying about what you told that teacher in college? I want to be a performer.
Yeah.
So you must have started doing some performing when you got to Berlin.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was mostly... I mean, when I moved over there, I was mostly working with... at that time, I was mostly working with French artists. And I was touring a lot in France. I started working with this guy, Stefan Eicher, from Switzerland. And Stefan's very successful in France, and he tours a lot. So I was mostly going down there and traveling around and doing live shows with him. And then, of course, you know... When you spend time in Paris, you meet all these other people, and I started working with a lot of different French artists, and so I get involved with these people, and they would want to make a new record, and of course, trying to do it in Paris, it's super expensive, it's really complicated, and all the studios are booked up way in advance, and so I started telling people about coming to Berlin to make records, so they started doing it. People started coming, you know, on the train or whatever, and come up there and stay.
What about this performance?
Well, this
is the first time I got to meet you and be conscious of it.
Right.
Because you know what? I probably did see you at Paul Rossler's pad.
Well, yeah, it's certainly possible.
Alzheimer laden.
I would have been sleeping on the couch.
Many shifts took.
Hanging out
many
in the
folks
kitchen.
Took many shifts at that. Yeah. And there was a lot of cats I met there that I can't remember. It's not their fault.
No, it's my fault.
No,
you know, I mean, Paul is a really open person. You know, he takes care of people. You know?
But this here,
yeah, this
girl, I saw you cats open for Stooges.
Yeah. Well, we played with the Stooges in Berlin. I think it was 2.5 years ago or something when Ron was in the band and you guys came through there. We did all the German shows. We played with you in Berlin and Hamburg and also outside of somewhere down around Cologne.
I think it was the old capital, Bonn.
Yeah, it was down somewhere down in there.
I think it was Bonn,
it was in the
it?
West. Yeah, it was in the southwest. And we did that. But, yeah, her name's Jessie Evans. And I met her actually in the same house where I'm living now. But it, you know, there were two studios in this house, and she had a band going at the time, and they were mixing a record with the engineer I'd been working with. So I met her there, and they had an electronic band. It was her and Bettina Koster from Malaria, and they needed a drummer for a show, and they asked me to do a show, and so we did some rehearsals, and that went really well, and I did some shows with them in the United States. But Jessie had been working on her own material, and Jessie had passed through several bands before.
Where's she original? What town?
She's from Mendocino, But she had a couple. She had a band called Subtonic. So I don't know if you ever knew about Subtonic.
Yeah, I remember those.
That was a really, really good, like, vicious all girl punk rock band.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, really influenced by the Ramones, but a little more like vampire vicious. I mean, really, really, really great
vampire
band.
Vicious.
Really vampire. They were killer. They were a great band, and. After that, she had a band called The Vanishing, which was also a really great punk band. And, you know, so she moved to Berlin, and she started this band with Bettina. You know, they made one record together. They called it Auto Nervous. And it's a great name. And anyway, they asked me to play drums with them, and I did that. And she was like, look, you know, I'm working on these songs of my own, and I really want to try and just start doing things under my own name. So we put this show together. And she had a lot of offers from booking agents all around the world and a lot of interest in this. And so we just put it together and started doing it.
Talking duet.
Yeah, just as two people. And, you know, she's a singer and plays saxophone, and she's a great dancer. So it's a very high-energy show. And she had a lot of interest in Mexico. And you know, when we first
on
met...
On the record here.
Yeah. Yeah, that record is produced by, have you ever heard of the Nortec Collective from Tijuana?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the guy who produced this record is Pepe Malt from the Nortec.
That's kind of like a...
Yeah, it's more electronic.
Yeah, my brother Matt, when I do my show in Pedro, my guy I do with Brother Matt, he knows all about the cats. He's playing
Yeah,
Furnace.
Yeah, they're fantastic. They do like a... They're like a
what
cross...
What do you call it, Toby Dammit here?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
well, we got to get into that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when did you start being called that?
Well, that kind of started around the mid-90s or so. But I was spending a lot of time
You're
in Paris.
You're not on the Ig Records as Toby
No,
Dammit.
No, no. I was still...
On the Swan Records.
No, I'm Larry.
See?
And all that stuff. But I started working with this guy in Paris. His name's Bertrand Bergelat. He's a very popular producer in France. And he's had his own record company in France called Tricatel for many, many years. And I was a big fan of everything he was doing. And he's an amazing musician and arranger, incredible mm-hmm. bass player. And we became best friends. And he started bringing me to Paris all the time to play on records for him, people he was producing, and commercials and all kinds of stuff. And at a certain point, like, he said, look, I've trademarked some weird names. He was, like, putting out all these weird compilation records, like Tricatel, like compilation records with all these different singers, and he was making so much music, he was just making up names for people, like false names and phony pseudonyms, and he was having a lot
phony
of
pseudonyms.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just well,
not
just
a real
make
pseudonym.
Well, he was making up pseudonyms and, like, you know, calling people all different kinds of names and registering them as artists and stuff, and they never existed and all this kind of stuff. And so. So one of the names he had trademarked the name Toby Dammit, which was this old Edgar Allan Poe character from 1853. And
what story?
It's a story called Never Bet the Devil Your Head.
Oh yeah.
It's a short story.
I know. I've read all this stuff when I was younger.
It's a rare story, but it's something you might find in a collection of short stories.
I have a thing of all this stuff.
It's really great. And
Hot
anyway,
Frog. I know all this stuff. Yeah. I mean, can't remember it all.
Well,
so there's a Toby Dammit there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, some years...
Is it like that with the two M's?
Yeah. And, you know, later in the 60s, there had been a French trilogy that was made with three different directors, and Fellini was one of the directors. And it was a trilogy of short films inspired by Edgar Allan Poe stories called Histoire Extraordinaire. And Fellini chose to do the Never Bet the Devil Your Head. And he called the film Toby Dammit. Terrence Stamp plays the character Toby Dammit in that film. Anyway, Bertrand had registered this name, and he's like, you know, he wanted me to make a solo record for him, you know, for his label. And he's like, you've got to be, I want you to be this Toby Dammit character. And so he told me all about it and talked me into it, and we thought it was funny. And so we did it. We made this record. And... So, you know, it came out, and there was a lot of interest. Like, there was Other Music in New York. They had a record company, you know, the record store Other Music in New York. They had a record company, and they released it. So, and they hired a publicity agent for the whole thing. So this whole thing just kind of snowballed.
Yeah.
And before I knew it, I was this new
persona.
Persona, and I just sort of ran with it, and, you know, everyone seemed to be having fun with it, and it just kept going on and on. And then I started working with all these artists in France, all of them top five, you know, like a lot of very popular records, and they all were listing me as Toby Dammit, and it just kept going on and on and on, and I couldn't stop it, you know, and I just sort of just let it go, you know, and someone made me a website, and I just thought, well, it's just going like that. So, you know, whatever. But yeah, so, when I met Jesse in Berlin, it was the same sort of scenario there. They were mixing their record in that house, and I was the grillmeister on the barbecue outside, and so we were out talking over the barbecue grill, and she was asking me, she was like, "Well, what do you miss the most about the United States?" And I told her, "Well, I don't really." I said, "I think the thing that I miss the most about the United States is actually Latino culture, because there's not very much Latino culture in Berlin,
and, not even in Spain."
Yeah, and well, of course, well,
no, I brought some. I make my own chili sauce. I brought some there. I made men cry.
You know,
I never had it.
Out of all the years of living in California, you know, I got, you know, I was always living in Latino neighborhoods, and I love the food and the music and the people so much and everything about it. And I was like, I really miss that. And she was like, well, me too. And we agreed, like, and, you know, we had both kind of left the United States for more or less for political reasons. And you know, we didn't really have a whole lot of interest in going back anytime soon for anything other than Latino culture, honestly. And we were like, well, you know, we should just go to Mexico. We were just thinking, we could just go to Mexico and bypass the United States completely, you know, and just do that. And, you know, we knew that we were going to make this record together, and we were like trying to think, like, we didn't want to do it in Berlin. And we were trying to think, we wanted to go someplace different and outside of, you know. And we just thought, why don't we go to Mexico and make the record in Mexico and get into this whole thing. And so we organized everything. We kind of figured out, like, where we were going to go. And I'd met this guy, Pepe Mocht, online, actually. I was a big fan of Nortec. And and we started writing back and forth together. And
Tijuana?
He lives in Tijuana. And so I said, look, you know, I'm going to make this record with this girl, Jessie Evans. You know, this is kind of like, these are the demos of what we've done, and check out these bands she's worked in and see what you think. Would you be interested to do it? And, you know, he checked it out and he wrote back. He's like, I'd love to do this. Like, why don't you guys come to Tijuana and let's do it? And I said, well, look, we're going to go through Mexico City first and we're going to record some stuff. We want to tour in Mexico. And kind of record as we're traveling. We record in motel rooms and all this kind of stuff, and do it kind of homemade.
Yeah.
And so that's the way we did it. We toured a couple of months around Mexico. We drove about 5,000 miles together, and just set. You know, we built a portable studio, and we drove around in a car, and we just broke the studio down and moved it to wherever we were going. We'd record vocals, you know, in a motel room like this, and, you know, and everywhere we'd go. We had drums.
This motel?
Well, yeah, hotel. This is a hotel. This is more of a hotel. But the truth is, we were recording in motels.
If you read my diaries,
yeah,
this is what is known as fancy band.
We met these beautiful people in Mexico City that had a bed and breakfast that we were staying in, and they knew.
Oh, you were telling this is a Burroughs band?
Yeah, and they knew that we were looking for a place to record, and we couldn't find a cool place that we liked. And finally, they said, look, you know, we have a laundry room up on top of the building that's kind of, you know, it's vacant. You know, there's two rooms up there. Why don't you take a look at it? We went up there. It was on the roof of their building, and it was like two bedrooms, and, you know, they were like, you can just have it, you know, just... Well, we were going to stay there for a couple of months, so we basically built this place out. You know, we set up mattresses along the walls and blankets everywhere, and kind of like dampened the room out, and we just turned that into our little studio. They gave it to us for free.
Cool.
And we recorded everything up there. It was fantastic. And We had a good time.
And Tijuana Cat, he mixed it?
He mixed it. Yeah, we drove all the way from, you know, we went as far down to Acapulco where we recorded in John Wayne's house. We played a gig in Mexico City and we met these kids that were huge fans of Jesse's. She has a big following in Mexico. And they came to see us twice. And the second time they introduced themselves and started talking to us. And they said, look, we have a house in Acapulco. If you want to come down and stay with us, you know, you'd be our guests. And please, you know, consider it. Well, in the end, Nortec got a little busy and they postponed the whole mixing thing for a couple of weeks. And we were trying to think, like, well, where could we go? We've been in Mexico City for a couple of months. Maybe we should go down and see those kids in Acapulco. And so we contacted them, and we decided to go down there. And Jesse was like, look, they said something about they had John Wayne's old house. And I did some research online, and look at these photos. I think it's this place. And, of course, it looked like a paradise. And I said, no, that's impossible. It can't be that place. It's probably like something around there, but surely not that. So we drove down to Acapulco, and we met them at night in the center of Acapulco, and they took us up the mountain, and we drove up and up and up and up and up, and we finally came up to this place, this closed gate, and someone brought them the key, and we went into this estate, and it was John Wayne's old house. And the story was the guy, his sister is a caretaker of this house, and it's not open to the public. And he had taken a week off of work, and he and his girlfriend were going to stay there with Jesse and myself. And they gave us John Wayne's bedroom. And the story that we got was, you know, in the 50s, John Wayne had bought property down there. Maybe you've heard about this, you know, like when he
went
down there.
I know he was living in Orange County. He got a minesweeper and converted to his boat, and he was living in Newport Beach.
Yeah. Well, I know about that place, too, but he had, in the 50s, he had gone down to Acapulco. It was very fashionable at that time. And he bought, you know, if you think of Acapulco as being a cove like a sea, the very top of that sea is sticking out into the Pacific Ocean. And basically, he bought the tip of that sea, the peninsula, that's sticking out the furthest into the Pacific Ocean. That was his property, his estate. And he had a custom bungalow built right on the cliff, with a swimming pool, with a big swimming pool right on the edge of the... I mean, it was unbelievable, like a paradise.
Yeah.
And beautiful place. And when he passed away, I believe his son went down to Acapulco and immediately sold the entire estate and took out his personal belongings and basically just left everything as it was. And the people that bought the place basically bought it, and then they locked it, and they never touched it. It's like frozen in time. They never sold it or rented it out or turned it into a museum or nothing. They just kept it like it was.
Yeah.
So all of his old furniture is there, everything.
Wow.
Everything. It's just like how he left it. So we went in there, and it was ours. They just gave it to us. They said, you can stay here for a week. And we set up our studio in his bedroom, and we stayed in his bedroom, in his bed. And Jesse and I, you know, we tracked every day or every night, and we drank micheladas all day. It made micheladas. You know, there are photos there of him and Dean Martin drinking in that kitchen. It was all the same. It was a real trip. It was like paradise. It was painful.
Was there water
to leave
in the pool?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
It was all, everything was fine. They never painted it or renovated or nothing. It was rotting, but it was beautiful. So we recorded a lot of stuff there, and then we drove from there all the way up to Tijuana, which is like a 3 or 4 day drive.
Yeah.
And we drove across the desert. It was fantastic. And we got to Tijuana, and we set up shop with Pepe there. And I'd never met him in person before, and he's one of the most beautiful people I've ever met in my life. He's a great guy and an amazing musician and an absolute genius. And so we stayed in a motel just down the hill from his house, and we would record stuff in the motel and walk up to his house and give him the tracks, you know. Like we had a system going. He was working with a fantastic engineer there in Tijuana, who is blind, and we wanted to do a lot of the songs in Spanish, And Jesse wanted to work with someone who could be a vocal coach for her in Espanol. So we worked with Lewis, and he recorded all of her stuff. It was at his house. It was an amazing experience. And the record came out great. It was a really wonderful adventure.
Let's play some.
All right.
Pedro Show. Wanted to play you some Jesse Evans music there. What Lair was talking about, his Mexican adventure. We had Blood and Silver. That almost brings us up to date.
Well, that's the main project that I've been working on the last several years. I think Jesse and I kind of started this project about 5 years ago. And she's been playing all over the world. You know, we play in Brazil and Russia and Norway and Mexico. We've toured Mexico 4 times, and we play almost everywhere around the world, but not very much in the United States. We've only done shows in
Canada.
We've only done shows in California, really.
Yeah,
we played one time on the East Coast. We did a live show on WFMU.
Great station.
And there are good friends and supporters.
Chris
there.
Turner.
We said we'd rather play there than play a live show in New York. So we went through there and played on their station. But we haven't really worked that much in the United States. But she's got a lot of guts, and we travel all over the world doing that. And of course it's her show that brought us together with the Stooges.
That's right. Brought
me working back.
Speaking of which, we didn't say, but Scotty got put in a hospital for hurts on his stomach.
And now he's better, and he had surgery. He came out, but he's got to heal up. So that's why Larry's playing here and saving the day. The decision was made to do the gigs, and two days of prac, people. Came in doing the throwdown Thursday. We're going to play here in Lisbon. And then Saturday's last of this leg in Valencia, Catalan part of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back on another one. I think first time I'll be to Corsica. Have you ever been there?
I've been there four times. I've been there two. I've been there two times with Jesse. And we were there about a month ago.
Wow.
It's beautiful.
Different from France? It's another part of France.
Yeah. It's
actually, France has got so many different regions. Reminds me of the U.S. in a way.
Well,
it's not like one land.
I'll come out and say it. It's not France, is what they would like me to say. So, but it's completely different from France. It's ruled by France, but you'll see that it is not like France. It's its own place. It's a beautiful, beautiful island, and the people are amazing, and the food is incredible.
We do play in France, Carcassonne.
Yeah, that's
awesome.
It's
beautiful by Spain.
Yeah. Have you been to Carcassonne?
Driving, not playing. Oh. That castle and shit.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It really is.
Well, you know, the thing about the Stooges thing, you know, I know it was short notice, but I'm not a stranger to these songs. And I'm not a stranger.
Remember the journey. Yeah, the music journey was a big part.
And I'm not a stranger to Scotty either. You know, yeah. I grew up listening to Scotty, and I mean, I've known his style and specifically what he's done in these songs all my life. And when we started doing these shows with Jesse with you guys, you know, like I was at the side of the stage the whole time the Stooges were playing, and I realized that was my chance finally to watch him play. Like, I'd listened to him all my youth, but I had the chance to actually watch him from behind, and I did that. I'm glad very much, especially now, that I actually did it, because I learned a lot. I wanted to watch and just kind of learn and see what I'd been doing wrong, you know, and really learn, like, see how it was really supposed to be done. And I learned a lot watching him. You know, I met him in 1990. I met him and Ron together the first time I came through Detroit with Iggy. And they were coming to the show, and I was super nervous. And they had come to the sound check, and there was a bar next door, and they invited us to come over to the bar after the sound check. So I went over next door and sat next to Scott then and was drinking beer with him then. And any time we ever went through the Detroit area, they always came by, and I always hung out with them. And, you know, so I've known Scotty for a while, and we had really good times on these shows, you know, when Ron was over here touring. And then also this last time we played together with you last year in Paris, and I had more time to hang out with Scott. And when I got the call that he was in the hospital, you know, I mean, I was shocked.
Yeah.
I mean, I was glad that he was okay. I mean, the news was positive that he was actually fortunate enough to be in good hands. And I think he's going to have a good recovery. But when, you know, when the people, you know, when the powers that be said that I had to do this, I realized that I had to do it, I mean, not just for myself. Number one, I had to do it for Scotty. Because I knew I was capable of doing this, and I knew that, you know, Scotty was worried about letting it, you know, they had told me that he was worried about letting everybody down. So I realized, like, if I come in and do this, he won't let anybody down. No one's going to be let down. The shows are going to be good, and I'm gonna, you know, whatever, carry the torch for him. And I know that I could do it. And the other thing was, you know, I had a long separation from Iggy after 9 years of really hard work. We had a long separation where we didn't speak. And I got a call from Iggy, you know, asking me to do this too. And I thought, well, this has been a long time. And if he's calling me, this first phone call I'd had from him in 12 years, you know. So I thought,
I thought, this is it, you know, like, I don't have a choice. There's no choice in this matter. Like, I have to step up to the plate and swing the bat, you know, and I have to pull this off.
Yeah.
For those reasons, you know, I have to support Scott. I have to support all you guys because it's a family, you know. It's like, it's kind of a tight thing here. So it's a family, and it's you know, it's like, just had to get it together for the right reasons, you know. Of course, it could have been anybody coming in to do this, but this was like keeping things on the inside, and I think it's for the right reasons.
Maybe it could have been anybody.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's you.
Well,
thanks for being on the show.
Well, I'm thanks for asking. I'm glad.
You know, to me, very interesting, very inspiring story of a musical journey. Righteous.
It is a musical journey. It's something that just, you know, it just started, and it just, I can't stop it, you know, and I just keep following it and stuff. Every year, new things seem to come out of the blue, and, you know, just keep going for it. I mean, it's like I told you before, it's the only, playing drums, playing music, it's like the only thing that I've ever been good at, and it's the only thing that ever came naturally to me.
Yeah.
And I grew up really poor, and when I realized that I was good at something, I had to grab a hold of it and stick with it, you know. And I've done the same thing since I was, I guess since I was 12, you know. So I just realized, like, you know, as soon as you learn something that you're good at, you know, when it's obvious, you know, stick to it and believe in it, you know.
Yeah.
And nurture it and try and get better at it, you know, and do all that you can with it, you know.
If you could sum it all up in one word, what word would that be?
One word.
Nick! It's been the Wide from Pedro Show, July 5, 2011. Thank you again, Larry. Keep your powder dry.